You too.
Today is Friday, February 20th, 2015. I call to order the House Committee on Human Services and Housing, and I'm opening a work session to introduce committee concepts. Vice Chair?
Yes, Chair Kinigair, I move that LC-3652 be introduced as a committee measure.
Vice Chair Stark moves that the following LC be introduced as a committee measure. LC-3652... dated, do we have the date?
Oh, goodness sakes.
I don't have the date.
It'll be on OLIS. Looking up the LC date.
Okay.
I believe it's yesterday. Thank you. Dated 2/19/15, be introduced as a committee measure. Is there discussion? No? Okay. Is there any objection? If not, the measure is introduced as a committee measure. I will now open a public hearing on House Bill 2.
She's not here yet.
Not 2. Okay. Well, let's move on then.
We're going to move on.
We'll open a public hearing and work session on House Bill 2442. Robin, will you read a summary of the bill, please? And the amendments.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this measure was before you on 2/11. You'll be looking at the proposed Dash 3 amendments. As you might recall, House Bill 2442 replaces the existing State Housing Council with the Oregon Stability Council, abolishes Advisory Committee on Energy and Community Development Incentive Advisory Committee, transfers authority to OHSC, abolishes the Interagency Council on Hunger and Homelessness, and transfers responsibility to OHSC, transfers responsibility for Oregon Hunger Relief Task Force to Department of Human Services. The Dash 3 amendments gives the director authority to provide Oregon Housing and Community Services financial and budgetary oversight. It directs Oregon Housing and Community Services to seek feedback from the Oregon Housing Stability Council on state housing plan. It defines the funding mechanism for the Oregon Hunger Task Force, harmonizes language, and clarifies name changes and usage. There is no revenue impact on the Dash 3s, and there is minimal fiscal impact on the Dash 3s. There's no subsequent referral.
Okay, let's start with the Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services.
Good afternoon, Chair Kinigair, members of the committee. My name is Margaret Van Vliet. I'm the Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. I wanted to just quickly recap the Dash 3 amendments. And you've got them before you, I believe. The first part of the amendments removes limitations on what this new council, the Housing Stability Council, can comment on in regards to our budget, and it adds authority to provide policy direction and a financial plan. It also gives the council the ability to review and comment on the state housing plan prior to its issuance. The amendments give the council the ability to develop policies to address geographic and racial disparities, as well as policies to ensure funds help meet other state priorities. The amendments request that the governor in appointing members give consideration to geographic distribution and a range of expertise in housing programs and services to people in poverty. It gives both the council and the Community Action Partnership of Oregon oversight over energy assistance programs and homeless assistance programs, and makes minor changes to the statute regarding hunger, including updating the name of the Oregon Hunger Task Force. It also changes the way that funds are provided for the Hunger Task Force. This is a piece that we worked on just this week, and I believe the partners are all very much in agreement. We've worked hard to make sure that is in place. So what's next is that we will work on something of a charter to document how we will this new council will work and how we will help it to report to the legislature. I also want to stress that we're going to be working hard with our partners at the utility companies and the community action agencies to come to consensus on a method to regularly report important data on our energy and weatherization programs as key funders. The utility companies are naturally very interested in making sure that when we dissolve ACE, that we do not lose the transparency and accountability back to the utilities, and that's very important to me as well. So we're going to work hard with them.
What ACE?
I'm sorry, the Advisory Committee on Energy is one of the advisory committees that is being dissolved and its duties given to this new Housing Stability Council. And we are committed to forming a subcommittee of the council to really focus specifically on energy and weatherization policy as it relates to the broader issues of housing stabilization. So with that, I'd be happy to answer questions.
This is a really big bill for your agency. I think that because you have worked so hard with the coalitions that are out there, so much of the going back and forth and should it spin off as a semi-autonomous, should it stay as a department and get streamlined, a lot of those discussions have happened in the community with fairly broad support. I know maybe not everyone is 100%, but I think you've had a lot of opportunity to look at all the pros and cons on the table, and I really just want to compliment you on the work of being so responsive. Heard from lots of different members of the community how responsive you've been, and kudos to your leadership. I'm hoping that you will just stay because we have two other speakers that we can, and if there's any questions that come up with for anything that they'll be talking about. So Varner Seaman and Elizabeth Howe.
Chair Kinney-Geyer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Varner Seaman, representing Portland General Electric. I want to speak in favor of the passage of HB 2442 on behalf of Portland General Electric. We've had some very productive conversations with the agency over the last week or last couple weeks. Agency is a very important partner for us in administering low-income housing and weatherization funds that are collected from PGE and Pacific core ratepayers through a couple of different pieces of legislation, and we had some concerns about, as Director Van Fleet just talked about, some concerns around how we would be able to have input into the administration of these funds and making sure that we had some good flow of information back and forth. I think that we've had some pretty productive conversations. We feel very comfortable with where we're at with the agency and just shared with you a letter that have shared with the agency kind of reflecting the conversations we've had. And with that, we're pretty happy to work collaboratively going forward, and please encourage the passage of HB 2442. And thanks very much to the director and the staff of OHCS for being so collaborative and for working with us. Thank you.
Chair Kinney-Geyer, members of the committee, my name is Elizabeth Howe. I represent Pacific Power, which serves about 560,000 customers throughout most of rural Oregon. We also just want to put on the record our thanks to the department and the director for working with us to address our concerns, just to make sure there's accountability and transparency in administering our low-income funds. And if you have any questions, we'd be happy to take them. Thank you.
Does anyone have any questions? So I will be very interested to hear a year from now when you testify how that this new arrangement is going now that ACE is being dissolved and it's becoming a subcommittee, just to make sure that the communication flow is going back and forth between the director and the people that are most involved in that particular piece of what the services that you provide. So thank you all for highlighting that relationship and making sure that we pay attention to it. Anything else you wanted to say? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
And before you leave, Margaret, let's just, Patty, would you like to address any piece of the amendment? I know you didn't sign up, but your opportunity to say something.
Thank you. Patty Whitney Wise with the Partners for Hunger Free Oregon and the Oregon Hunger Task Force. We worked with Margaret and the staff over the week on the amendment, and we feel very good about it. And I appreciate the partnership and the hard work.
Okay, great. So the Hunger Relief Task Force and the Oregon Hunger Fund, not sure if
I'm saying Hunger Response Fund.
Hunger Response Fund are going over from OHCS to DHS. And so there's been a lot of attention drawn to the fact that hunger is a huge issue in Oregon, and we want to make sure as it makes that shift that it's got a warm welcome home and that we collectively figure out how we can continue to fund this program, because it'll come under a new arrangement. So that will be future discussions. Right.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank
so you. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Okay. Anyone else want to testify? All right. We will now move to the amendments. Do I have a motion?
Chair Kinnegar, I move to adopt the Dash 3 amendments dated 2/16 of 2015.
Vice Chair Stark moves to adopt the Dash 3 amendments dated 2/16/15. Is there any discussion? Okay, is there any objection? If not, the amendments are adopted.
Chair Kinnegar, I move House Bill 2442 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Stark moves House Bill 2442 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Rep. Bueller?
Excused.
Rep. Evans?
Yes.
Rep. Gallegos?
Aye.
Rep. Hayden?
Aye.
Rep.
Parrish? Aye.
Rep. Taylor?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stark?
Yes.
Vice Chair Kulisa?
Excused.
Chair Kinnegar?
Aye. The motion passes. Congratulations.
Thank you.
To you and the whole community. Good work.
So I'm going to close the
public hearing. Okay, we're going to close the public hearing in the work session on House Bill 2442.
Open hearing on this?
Okay, and we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2232. Robin, can you give us a summary of the bill, please?
Certainly. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2232 requires the Department of Human Services appoint advisory committee on coordination of statewide services for homeless and runaway youth, specifies committee role and composition, declares an emergency effective on passage. There's no revenue impact, may have a fiscal impact, statement not yet issued. And that's it.
Okay. We have two people signed up, Janet Ahrens. I never know if it's Ahrens or Ahrens. Ahrens.
They're both doing.
Okay. And Mike Balter. Is there anyone else who wants to testify on this bill? Oh, we're zipping through.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here and talk to you a little bit about runaway and homeless youth in Oregon today. My name is Janet Ahrens. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Alliance of Children's Programs. We're a statewide nonprofit that takes care of other nonprofits who take care of kids. We deliver about $223 million worth of services to over 100,000 children. 10 of our members are themselves runaway and homeless providers who who we're representing in this conversation with you today. And here's my electronic version of their logos and pictures and their districts in the state. So, you know, my apologies, I didn't make it into the submitted testimony. But the children that and youth that they take care of touch all of your districts. The other way in which we touch all of your districts is this document that was emailed to you in our packet, and you have an opportunity here to take a look and see how many homeless school-age children are in your legislative district, and of those, how many of them are unaccompanied youth. The what's important to understand on the unaccompanied minors is that there are about out of about 16,000 homeless youth identified in schools, over 3,000 of them are unaccompanied youth. We know from other data that you need to double that number because there are an equal number who are not attending school for, as you can imagine, quite a number of reasons. Unaccompanied youth are really important to us. They are the kids who are the most likely to be crime victims. They are the kids who are most likely to be sex trafficked. They're also the kids who still have resiliency intact and who, with the right work and interventions and connections with their families and connections to services, can be reunited in safe homes. We also conducted a study this last year of over 800 children out of the 100 sample out of the 100,000 kids that we represent to take a look at their ACE scores. And most of you already know what that is, the adverse childhood experiences. And if there is a score of four or more of these adverse experiences, you move into a very difficult probability of having behavioral and health and learning difficulties. The ACE score for the our youth are 59%. Those are the ones that have a score of four or more. And Mike's going to show you a little bit of information that talks a little bit about other events in the lives of runaway homeless kids and how they end up there. And also in your packet is this study that we did, and here's the impact on trauma and learning and behavior and health issues. So to get down to the chase here, the Oregon spends, one of the other challenges, frankly, that these children and youth have is that Oregon makes nearly a $900 million investment on the 8,000 children who are in foster care on any given day in Oregon. We spend $1.8 million on the nearly 19,000 homeless children that we have in our state, and that includes, again, the 16,000 or the 6,000 unaccompanied youth we talked about. So the Alliance has been very, very invested in this population and made it a top priority for the organization in 1998 because nobody else was really taking care of these kids. So we dug in to advocate for them and represent them. And since then, we've introduced five different pieces of legislation. We've pulled three different task forces and groups together to complete specific tasks. We've conducted three studies. And we've worked very, very hard to secure the funding which the Department of Department of Human Services currently has for this fledgling system, and that's $1.8 million. So in the present, our members have banded together over the last 2 years to establish data that demonstrates what the outcomes are. They've assessed community needs. They've made determinations on where funding should be focused and what the product for that funding is. What kind of outcomes are we going to get, and where is that money going to go? We're really, really very proud of that work. But we have some limitations on how far we can get with that information, which Mike is going to visit about in a minute. The Department of Human Services, who inherited this population 4 years ago, has made individual contact with the providers, which we're very pleased about. They love to show off their programs and talk about the kids and the issues, and so that's a very positive relationship to build. They've polled and surveyed folks to find out what their opinions are on certain subjects and interests they might have. They've made some linkages for providers to trainings that are available that might assist them in their technical support for their programs. But none of the work that's been done has gone directly to the original bill that put them into the Department of Human Services Child Welfare Division. We do not have a strategic plan for these kids. We do not have system development. We do not have a plan for a sustainable system that's going to get the right kinds of outcomes for these kids. That's the piece that we're here to ask for your help on. We think that the original legislation that was introduced had a lot of motivation in it for why this would be a really, really good idea to put together an advisory committee to do this work. The mandate is pretty clear in the bill. It's not really clear that they have to have a work group or advisory committee. So we would like to secure that possibility with your support on the bill today.
So my name is Mike Balter. I'm the president emeritus of Boys and Girls Aid. You have testimony that looks like this electronically, hopefully. I'm not going to go through this testimony. Boys and Girls Aid has provided homeless and rural youth services in Washington County and to some degree in Clackamas County for probably 50 years. I'm the chair of the affinity group of the Alliance for Homeless Runaway Youth Programs, and you'll see the list of those programs in the material I provided to you. Janet did a really nice job, I think, of laying out the history and the relationship. She was cautious about the level of frustration. I'm not going to be cautious. I'll be honest with you. I think it's damning in some ways that the state currently invests $1.8 million in these kids. That's for a biennium. So it's less than $1 million statewide for this group of young people, 30% of whom are products of the foster care system. Unaccompanied minors, the simple definition is they don't have a parent or an adult who is responsible for them. So there are 6,000 young people that are identified already that don't have an adult. These kids are dependent. By any judicial court ruling, they would be dependent minors, yet they cannot get services. So I'm not crazy about advisory committees. Janet talked me into this. But if you look at my testimony, there's words that are where the department is responsible for coordinating. They shall recommend policies. They're to develop comprehensive coordinated approaches. The language is all here. So the frustration is, how do we help them embrace these young people fully? In my judgment, that's all it is a judgment that I don't believe that either the Commission on Children and Families or the department has embraced these kids thoroughly. My evidence of that is that over the last, since 2005, as a small group of providers, really, and I think the work we do is with kids is very good. The systemic planning we do is mediocre at best, because that's not our primary role. But if you look at these types of documents, the ones I submitted electronically, this is the type of thing I would expect from the department, and we had hoped for from the department and from the commission. It talks about the number of kids statewide. It talks about outcomes. It talks about a continuum of care from street outreach to transitional living. It's modeled after federal programs that have been in operation for 35 to 40 years. As much as I love this, it's not as complete as it should be because we're a limited group. The second thing I would hope for the department to develop with us or for us is this type of a document. We cannot advocate successfully for these young people if we can't articulate per region and per district what they need. This is our rudimentary beginnings of that, to get to some way of asking for resources from the state that would match some of the other resources we've generated. Okay? We'll go to ways and means with this. It's inadequate. You know, we didn't have the resources. There is no services in Eastern Oregon for these kids. The one service that closed was one that wasn't successful in a recent RFP by the state. So there's a desperation you're hearing from us, because this is a document we should be supporting the department in. They should be laying out what's the need for the kids by region. These are the regions they picked. These are electronically,
should be in the meeting
and if not, I handed out hard copies to the clerk. Okay, and then And the last thing is, because these are all the questions you're going to ask us, or Ways and Means will surely ask us, this is an array of programs that are member agencies that are in your districts, quite frankly. And this is the level of resources that is currently being invested for these young people from other sources. They're $7 million. The state's investing $1 million. These are state children. We're generating more private dollars than the state's investing in these kids as private agencies. Counties, Multnomah County is investing $4 million in these kids from county funds. These are the types of documents, and this is what we're trying to get to. Mm-hmm. And I think an amendment we'll probably ask is that the state report back to you. These are the tools that are necessary to be successful advocates. And my evidence, I don't believe this department has embraced these children, is they don't have any of these tools. And if they do, they have not produced them for us. And we've been begging them. We've shared everything we have. I shared my testimony with the department on Monday, hoping that they would come back and say, okay, we're ready. And what they said was, well, we did trainings. So if there's a little frustration you're hearing from me, it's true. I'm a little frustrated. So I hope this is, you have a good sense of why we're, I don't know that this is the right solution, but I think it's the best solution we have today. And we hope you'll maybe support us in Ways and Means.
Are there questions yet?
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer. Thank you both so much. And I share your frustration. However, I have a sneaking suspicion that you're dealing with this on a more intimate level than perhaps I am. I really do appreciate everything that both of you have said, and I like the fact that you've laid out and defined. I've been asking, and my colleagues can attest to, how many kids are actually unaccompanied versus I appreciate the homeless count, but this is really drilling down to how many people don't even have a parent, which is very, right. very serious. And but you just mentioned something that I wanted to clarify, and I don't know if you know the answer to it or not, is you talked about that they haven't been identified, you know, put a label on maybe is what you're, I don't want to put words in your mouth, that they were not part of the foster system or they're not right. part of something, right. and so right. then they're not maybe getting the services. And so can you just go back to that and right. clarify what you were saying so I understand better?
And this is an argument that I think is a difficult one okay. because none of the state departments at this point want to generate more census. They don't really want to. I had one of the deputy directors at a point say, we're not looking for caseload increases.
Okay.
But these are minors, and most of them are probably over of age 12, the ones we're most concerned about. Younger children are usually with their parents or some, they're not unaccompanied. It's the unaccompanied adolescents. The school and the 3,000 that are in schools, those we know for sure, that's a hard count because the schools count all those kids and they ask the kids, do you have a parent or a relative or a guardian? Is there an adult that's responsible for you? And they'll answer no. To me, as a former child protective service worker, that's a dependent child. Okay, so if I went and filed a petition on this young person in court and said, this is a dependent minor who has no parental or guardian protection, they would be awarded, the state would be awarded guardianship on those kids. Now, unless the laws change dramatically, these are kids who have no one who's responsible for them.
Okay, follow up?
Yep.
Well, maybe I need to ask Chair Kenny Geyer because I know she has a lot more experience with all of this than I do. So who do we need to bring in to testify about what needs to happen with the school districts at that moment when a child, when they find out, or what needs to happen in the process so that when this has been identified, that the child is directed to the right services, the right individual is called, instead of just saying, right. yeah, we know that that person is now an unaccompanied minor, that the next step is that they get the services they need. What?
You may know the answer.
Well, I think the difficulty, and I understand the complexity of these young people because we serve them all the time. Oftentimes, if you have child protective services come, they'll run away. Or maybe they've run away from a foster care already. Okay. So I think we're trying to create this array of services, street outreach, shelter, transitional living, that says, okay, that's their condition. But we need resources that are equivalent to kids that are in care or some level of service so that these young people are not left to their own devices to raise themselves. I'm not suggesting that they should all go to court and we should put them all in foster care. I don't think that's a wise choice. But I think there has to be more aggressive. Our highest value is to reunite these kids with their parents, you know, and we're successful in the shelter system on about 64% of the time. So there's hope there. That's the first place you go. And many times they're considered unaccompanied because their parents maybe have left. I mean, they've left the county or the area that they're in. So you have to go out and look for them.
So, Chair Kindergarten and President Taylor, that Mike said something really important. We are already serving those youth. We have evidence-based practices. We have a system in place. And what we need with this bill is to collaborate in a public-private partnership with not only child welfare, but with the other entities who also touch these kids with drug and alcohol, with mental health, with housing. And so we need that coordinated, united approach to be able to solve the problem. Our goal, if you look at this mythical piece of document that isn't in your packets, it's our goal is to end homelessness. Our second goal is to provide the best possible services for these kids and the most opportunities for reuniting with families to be safe, to graduate from high school. That's the other issue. These kids don't graduate from high school. So we have the tools, but we don't have the coordinated, committed mechanism to build that statewide system that's going to have the same impact that we're having in a very small portion now.
Thank you. We're going to start.
Thank you, Chair Kindergeyer. Mr. Salvaggio? Did I say it right?
No,
am I even close?
No, it's not.
No, I'm just Balter.
That's the wrong one?
The wrong one.
Salvaggio
is not here.
Okay, well, I apologize for
Mike Balter.
It's for calling you the wrong
Olis
name.
Yet. Yeah.
I was looking at the only male in Olis.
Yeah, he's not. They're not in
All right.
Yet.
So I want to make sure I understand your testimony, and so I'm going to repeat back to you what I think you're saying. Okay. What it sounds like you're saying, and getting back to the point of this bill, is not about what services are not being offered. To my understanding, the point of this bill, based on your testimony, is that you feel like that the DHS is not adequately partnering with their community partners, analyzing their data, and having strategic planning to deal with the issue of homelessness. And therefore, this bill would force their hand to do an advisory committee to incorporate all of that with their community partners to have a better strategic plan. Is that what I'm understanding here?
Yes.
Am I understanding properly? Representative
Stark, I'd add one other thing. The end product really, I think this bill, the testimony we're giving right now is about the advisory, but it's really about the tools. There has to be a framework for us to come to the legislature and talk about the needs of these kids that's understandable. And right now there isn't. And so the reason we want to collaborate so closely with the department is so we can generate tools like the samples that I gave you, that they embrace also. So we're coming together to request resources in an organized, thoughtful way that's systemic, that can address the needs of these kids in an organized and thoughtful way rather than a county-by-county or provider-by-provider way. Is that helpful?
So this is, you know, a pretty bare-bones bill as it stands right now. Is your intention then to work with Representative Nathanson, who introduced this, and I know that Representative Evans is on the bill as well, and try to flesh out some of the pieces that you think need to be there right now? It doesn't say what the membership will be constituted. It says meet regularly. Are there pieces that you want to put in here? The report back?
Okay.
Yeah. What would you like to propose that would help make this more concrete in laying out that framework?
Thank you very much for the question. Again, another piece of mythical testimony that's floating out there. Actually, it's in Mike's testimony. If you look at this, here's the language in the bill that it already exists.
Okay.
That was written and passed into law by the legislature in 2005 and was recommitted when the commission began to shut down to Child Welfare and Department of Human Services. Exact same language. It talks about who the partners are, who you can bring to the table, what the charge is, what the purpose is. All we need to do is make it a requirement instead of making it an option for the department. And we would like to work with Representative Evans and Representative Nathanson on a small amendment to require reporting back to the legislature on progress.
Okay, that testimony's not in OLIS yet, and I think there maybe weren't enough copies to go around, so I'm not seeing it, but I'm hearing you say that you would like to submit that idea that's in your written testimony for consideration as an amendment to this bill.
Yes, thank you.
It was also received electronically, though, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So it's
Ty can get it uploaded right now.
So
we just haven't gotten it yet.
Okay. Well, we're not moving. It's just a public hearing. Thank you for alerting it to us. And my apologies if it hasn't gotten up here yet. It will.
I'd just like to respond to the, not to undermine Janet, but I think we're reluctant to put too many more details because it's the concept. It's the notion of collaboration and working together. And then some level of reporting back to the legislature about what tools did they create, so that we're actually, you know, developing those tools. So I think if we put on too many other details, we'll get caught up in the task force structure. I don't know if that's essential.
Mm-hmm.
It's that there's a way of bringing us all together and having a systemic plan.
So I just want to thank you for bringing this to us. I mean, clearly it's a issue we want to address. I mean, I'm also concerned about the third that don't get back to their families.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know what that number would be, but I'm sure it's significant. I also like that the data that you pulled together is really statewide, and I appreciate that because I know that it's tremendously different depending on the rural communities and the urban. Thank you.
I was just going to mention also you may be tracking House Bill 2297 was heard in the Health Committee. And that's to form a task force that really lays out a whole roadmap. They have a beautiful roadmap that Tony Biglin put forward from prenatal through young adulthood and all the different interventions that need to happen along the way. And, his testimony was very much the same thing. We don't have a roadmap of how we're doing behavioral, physical supports for our kids. And so it seems like there should be some kind of merging of some of these ideas, or at least representation from a more narrow advisory group that is looking more specifically at homelessness, but making sure that that ties into the bigger vision of how do we prevent some of those things before kids become homeless. So,
thank you, Chair Geyer. We testified in support of that bill.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah,
and I can also send you again electronically this material. So,
you have it? We have it.
Okay.
We'll get it up. Thank you so much. Anyone else want to testify on this bill? Children First will probably want to be engaged in helping gather data. They do the annual report card back. Okay, so I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2232 and open a work session on House Bill 2610. Robin, can you please give us a summary of the bill?
Certainly. Madam Chair, members of the committee, this measure was before you on February 9th. You'll be looking at the proposed Dash 1 amendments. The amendment changes the allowable tax year from July 1st, 2014, and extends it to July 1st. Rather, it changes the allowable tax year to July 1st, 2014, through July 1st, 2016. And there is a minimal revenue impact and minimal fiscal impact.
So, Representative Gallegos, would you like to say anything about this bill before we entertain a motion?
Sure, I'd love to. Yeah, I just want to, clarify with the committee that this is basically a technical fix. I mean, it's not, it's really just, what's the term I want to use? It's a jurisdictional fix. It really will allow then us to proceed with what was intended in terms of the tax credit process.
The farm worker tax credit. Are there any questions about this bill? Okay. Can I have a motion?
I am vice chair. Wow. Sorry. Chair Kinnegar, I move to
You're
adopt.
You're rising up fast.
All right, let's try that again. Chair Kinnegar, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated 0209 of 2015.
Vice Chair Stark moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated 0209-15. Is there any discussion? Mm-hmm. Is there any objection? If not, the amendment is adopted.
Chair Kinnegar, I move House Bill 2610 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded. All right, well, let me try that one more time. Mm-hmm. Chair Kinnegar, I move that House Bill 2610 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and the subsequent referral to the Committee on Revenue be rescinded.
Okay, Vice Chair Stark moves House Bill 2610 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Revenue be rescinded. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll. Excused?
Representative Evans?
Aye.
Representative Gallegos?
You bet.
Representative Hagan?
Aye.
Representative
Perry? Aye.
Representative
Aye.
Vice Chair Stark?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Excused?
Chair
Kinnegar? Aye. The motion passes. The bill is sent to the floor. And Representative Gallegos, would you like to carry this?
To. Thank you.
Okay. That's great. Thank you. And now we are going to open an informational hearing on overview of tax credits relating to elderly, disability, and health care with Chris Alanak and Deanna Mack. And I'll just say also, while they're getting settled, that part of why, one of the things we want to do before we start moving some of the dependent care and other work credits, that the tax credits that we've been looking at, is get a feel for some of the other tax credits that are out there so we can look more holistically.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Chris Alanak, Legislative Revenue Office. And I have just, it's a short PowerPoint presentation. It's an overview of the slides. I mean, an overview of the six tax credits that encompass that area. So I was just going to walk through those six or ten slides, and it's pretty high-level information and still in progress in terms of compiling all of the data that you may or may not be interested in, I suppose. The six tax credits, the first four are related to disabilities. The first one is a severe disability. That's for the taxpayer and spouse. There's a loss of limbs tax credit. There's an elderly or disabled tax credit, which is a function of a federal tax credit. There's a child with a disability tax credit. And then there are two other kind of healthcare related tax credits. There's a long-term care insurance tax credit related to the purchase of long-term care insurance. And then the last one is a tax credit for the costs in lieu of nursing home care. Basically, if somebody pays for the care of an elderly person in their home, they can get a tax credit. So just briefly, just conceptually, what these tax credits get at. And there is a degree of overlap among the tax credits and the definitions of disabilities. So that might fit the theme of consolidating the tax credits in one way or another. The severe disability, it's basically for the loss of use of at least one leg or both hands, or if the taxpayer is unable to engage in any substantial gainful activity. And a lot of these terms are further defined in statute. And if you really want to get into the weeds, you can get into that level of detail, but then try to keep it at a fairly high level. Or if the taxpayer has a physical or mental condition that limits their ability to earn a living or maintain a household or provide their own personal transportation. And this tax credit, the value of this tax credit is tied to the personal exemption tax credit, which in 2012 was $183. And the reason I use 2012 is there are a couple of charts here that are all in tax year 2012. I also have a chart on the personal exemption credit that'll provide a little more context for what that tax credit is. The loss of limbs tax credit.
Can you stop for 1 second? So if you, this is not a federal one, this is Oregon State only?
This is an Oregon only.
And if you qualify for it, you get 183, or that's an average?
That's the, in 2012, that was the maximum.
That was the maximum you could get. So based on your income? Or based on what?
Well, the personal exemption credit is a piece of the tax system, and every taxpayer is allowed a personal exemption tax credit. At the federal level, if you can recall that chart, which last week, at the federal level, there's a certain exemption amount, and they're basically several thousand dollars that are not subject. It's kind of like a deduction at the federal level. Mm-hmm. In Oregon, we have this credit, so taxpayers figure out their tax, and then they can reduce that tax by the personal exemption credit. So a single filer will get one personal exemption credit. A family of four will get four personal exemption credits.
This just gives you an additional one.
An additional one. Mm-hmm. There are two that are like that. And they're, well, yeah.
And I remember blind being in this too, but is it only if you're blind and that makes you unable to engage in gainful activity?
Right. Or
is it
permanently? Permanently blind.
Permanently blind, even if you can still engage in gainful activity, like Stevie Wonder?
Madam Chair, for the record, Deanna Mack, Department of Revenue, and that is correct. It is if you're permanently blind,
qualify for this.
Correct. Okay. You don't have any other conditions on there.
Yeah. The loss of limbs tax credit is for the loss of both legs or both arms or one arm and one leg, and that's a straight-up $50 tax credit. And that could be for the taxpayer and or spouse if they qualify.
There's a big overlap right there.
And just about everybody who claims the loss of limbs will get the severe disability.
And as I recall, per year, the severe disability was about $5.5 million. The loss of limbs was $25,000.
Yes, in order of magnitude.
Right.
And I do have a chart later on that will get that, okay. But that's the order of magnitude, yes. The other two disability tax credit, the first one here, the elderly or disabled, this is the one that's tied to federal law. And this is for taxpayers who are age 65 or older or who are retired on permanent and total disability and receiving taxable disability income. And the Oregon credit is simply 40% of the federal credit.
And there's no means testing?
I'm still working through the calculations of the federal tax credit. I don't think it's a very large credit. Mm-hmm. So I'm still trying to boil that down so I can explain it simply. Because as with all things federal, it's a very complicated form and calculation for the small credit. The fourth one is a child with a disability, and this is one I think Deanna wanted to comment on a little bit in terms of DOR's experience with it. But this is for a dependent who is eligible for early intervention services or special education. And statute goes on to list a lot of things that would qualify a child with a disability. But this is one that is also tied to the personal exemption credit. So two of the four are tied to other tax policy. And then I think Deanna wanted to talk a little bit about this one, or?
I'll just wait.
Oh, okay. So at a high level, that's generally what those four tax credits are.
And on the disability one, the personal, the child and personal dependent, I'm sorry, the child and dependent care talks about children with a disability or handicapped. Is a definition of that the same?
There's some overlap here, mm-hmm. and that's one of the things that I'm trying to get at is in terms of use of the credits, how many people are claiming that child and dependent credit as well as some of these credits.
Okay.
This is the personal exemption tax credit. This is the part that I was just describing, and it is indexed to inflation. And the solid line there shows the history of the amount of the tax credit, and the dashed line shows the current law forecast for what that credit will be. So embedded in for the child with a disability and the severe disability, the value of that credit grows with this credit.
Didn't we in the grand bargain also cap it?
The personal exemption credit now is only available to tax filers under $100,000 of AGI for single or $200 for joint. But the two disability tax credits are not capped. As part of the grand bargain, they got caught up in that and were capped. And then in 2014, in the short session, you passed a bill that reinstated those two disability tax credits.
So even if you don't qualify for year one because of income, you can still qualify for this?
For the disability, yeah. That's correct. So here's a table just showing kind of an order of magnitude of the credits. The severe disability, you have about 40,000 claimants claiming about $7.5 million in credits and using $5 million. So this gets at your question a few minutes ago, Madam Chair. And the average claimed was 184. Again, that's the tax personal exemption credit, and they're able to use 124 because a lot of the taxpayers don't have sufficient liability. These are non-refundable credits. And then the child with a disability, you have about 26,000 claimants using about $4.5 million. And then the other two, you get to be relatively small. For the elderly and disabled, only about 1,300 claimants, and the loss of limbs were down to about 400 claimants each year. And so the order of magnitude there is very different. And here's just a distribution of who is claiming the tax credit for 2012 full year filers. The gray bar is the elderly and disabled, and they're pretty much just in those first two categories, filers with income under $20,000. And then the orange bars are the severe disability, and the blue bars are the child with a disability tax credits. So you can see how that spans the income spectrum for the claimants. And then I only have two more slides and just wanted to touch base on the healthcare tax credits. The first one is the long-term care insurance credit. There's a personal side to this and a business side. For individuals or families, the coverage, it's for insurance for the coverage of the taxpayer, a dependent, or the parent of the taxpayer, and the amount of the tax credit is 15% of the premium paid up to $500. Businesses are allowed to claim a credit for insurance that they purchase for the coverage of their employees, and the amount of the credit for them is 15% of the premiums, or $500 per covered employee, whichever is less. And the costs in lieu of nursing home care, there are two sets of qualifications. One is for the taxpayer who gets to claim the credit, and then there's one for the individual who is receiving the care. So the eligible taxpayer is the person who incurs the expenses, and they must have income of up to $17,500. So it's a very low income.
Could you give a scenario? Because I'm not sure who you're talking about.
This could be a person, a low-income person with income less than $17,500 who is caring for a parent or a grandparent.
Cost in lieu at home?
They're keeping them at... It could be at home. It could be... other costs that they incur, the person they don't have to be living in the same home. But they could be incurred, so it could be costs that you incur for taking care of your parent or your grandparent wherever they're living.
So does this overlap with the dependent care tax credit?
It could.
Mm-hmm.
And then the qualified individual has to be age 60 or older and have income of no more than $7,500. And there are a couple of other requirements about being eligible for Oregon Project Independence, but not taking advantage of the program. And the amount of the credit is only up to $250. It's 8% of the expenses or $250, whichever is less. And this is a tax credit where there are fewer than 50 claimants per year. It's not very widely used. Arguably, a reason for that is all of the income limitations in this have not been indexed to inflation.
And what kind of expenses is it for?
Madam Chair, I can find out for you what expenses are involved. I think it has to do with the care of the actual, of the individual.
Chair Kenninger, the numbers in this appear to be so small to me, like $7,500 to $17,500, and the amount of tax credit they can get. What, if you can give me your opinion of the efficiency of this, or does that need to have a cost of living increase there, or those limitations? I mean, somebody that earns $7,500 probably is unlikely to have a tax liability.
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, the $7,500 is for the person receiving the care, so they're not claim, they don't get the tax credit. It's the taxpayer who provides the care and incurs the expenses. Mm-hmm. So okay. It's basically a low-income individual providing care for another lower-income individual.
Okay.
Where low-income is very low.
But maybe because it's not refundable, it's not being used.
Well, it's not refundable. Well, the credit itself is capped at $250, mm-hmm. and that's none of these parameters have been indexed to inflation. And I'm trying to look up when it was created in 1979, and none of these have been inflation adjusted since 1979. So you're comparing $17,000 in 1979 versus $17,000 in 2015.
And you're the math guy, so indexed to today, would that be five times what those are if they had been indexed, roughly?
In order of magnitude, that is probably close. I can confirm that and get you a more exact number. But we often see that in programs that aren't indexed to inflation, when you have these hard caps over time, people will be forced out of the program because they're just inflation will drive up incomes, even the low incomes.
So whatever. It makes more sense to do it probably to the federal poverty line.
Something like that, and then inflation gets built into that.
Yeah, because they just don't seem to make sense.
But then it gets back at the policy of, I mean, it's tied in the, in terms of the indirect spending and the direct spending, this program, even in statute, is tied to Oregon Project Independence, where you need to be able to qualify for that but not benefiting from Oregon Project Independence. So in some respects, at least from a program perspective, setting aside the limitation of program parameters, it's a complement to Oregon Project Independence.
This is not in lieu of, if you're in Project Independence, Oregon Project Independence, you can claim this?
This is, I think this, that's part of the in lieu of, or OPI.
Oh, it's in lieu of it.
Right. I think that's largely where, the in lieu is basically if you're not in a nursing home care and you're trying to provide for that care of the person in a residential setting, for example. It's consistent with that broad theme within Oregon policy of keeping people at home as long as possible and all of the benefits that go along with that, as opposed to putting people into nursing homes and so forth.
Madam Chair, to answer your question about the qualifying expenses, they are for that the person that the care is being provided for, but it's the expenses are food, clothing, medical costs, prescriptions, transportation expenses, the cost you incur to take them to and from doctor's appointments, lodging is not a qualified expense. So those are examples.
So follow up, Chair Kenninger. So just to be clear, the actual amount of the tax credit is also not indexed, right? And so that's why these numbers right. look so small on both sides of the equation.
Right. I mean, this is one, for example, just in terms of policy review, and this might be a good example for part of the genesis of this process, is this credit was established in 1979, and then aside from some technical things, a sunset was added in 2009, and there was a, Well, that was it. There were other technical changes. But basically, it was put in place in 1979 and hasn't looked at since.
Thank you, Chair Kenegaira. I'm sorry, maybe I missed it. How much does this tax credit come to? What does this cost this state?
Maybe $10,000 a year. It's about 50 taxpayers, maybe 30 taxpayers, and claiming a credit of about $45 on average. It's very small. It's almost non-existent.
And this is in Oregon only?
Correct.
Both of them are Oregon only?
Correct. Other states have a long-term care insurance credit. I mean, it's not uncommon for states to have that.
Uh-huh. Do you have any guess on what it administratively costs you to run both of these?
Madam Chair, the cost in lieu of nursing home care doesn't, I can about say that it probably doesn't cost us anything to administer it. I know that there is an agency, I think it's DHS, or is it?
DHS has to certify the credit. Certification process.
Right, so there is a minor certification process for that. But for us, there isn't. For the long-term care insurance premium, it would be just business as usual. If we come across it, needs to be examined. But it's just another line on the form at this point.
Okay. It's what we refer to as an auditable item.
Right.
So if you get audited, you need to be able to show, the taxpayer needs to be able to show, yes, I paid X dollars for my long-term care insurance, and that worked out. There's
and no
does other.
Oregon audit? Do you audit?
Madam Chair, we do. And when we come across it, then we'll ask them to provide their expenses. It just depends on if the return is selected. Mm-hmm. It's for other, you know, multiple reasons or whatever triggers. But if it's there, we'll look at it. Yeah.
Can you give me an example of a long-term care insurance, like a person in long-term care? Like, and just run me through.
That would be any person in this room who decides to purchase long-term care insurance.
Before we're in the long-term
Correct.
Care itself. Just
the incentive is...
The incentive for people to buy long-term insurance.
Exactly. And I touch on it in the report. Part of the incentive there was driven by demographics and the potential burden placed on the Medicare, Medicaid system down the road. And one of the questions in evaluating the tax credit here is whether or not it actually defrays some of those costs by shifting the burden of those costs from the public sector of Medicare, Medicaid to the private sector through the insurance policies that people would purchase. The argument for the tax credit is that with the tax credit, people will be encouraged to buy the insurance where otherwise they would not, especially at younger ages. Now in the report, I have a table chart that shows the age for people claiming the credit. And generally speaking, it's people aged over 50 that claim the credit. Mm-hmm. So they're the ones purchasing it, assuming that they know about the tax credit. And I'm not an expert on the insurance, but I believe the younger you are when you purchase it, the cheaper it is. But it can be pretty tough to get somebody who's 25 right. to purchase long-term care insurance, roughly speaking.
And how many people use this?
There were
38,000 about?
Yeah.
Madam Chair, about 38,000 in tax year 2012.
Yeah.
An interesting graph.
Yeah. That's the.
Because it's not shifting it off of Medicaid, maybe Medicare, but not off of Medicaid. It's not the low income people
that are purchasing
and claiming the credit. And the higher income people are not going to be claiming Medicaid. I don't know enough about Medicare to know.
But
this is saved to people on long term. Insurance save the Medicare system because they have long-term
All right. insurance. This is one where there does seem to be a body of research out there about this, and I had just touched the surface of trying to find out what was out there, commenting on the efficiency of tax incentives to get people to purchase it. Because the real issue The impact of the long-term care insurance and the Medicare system is one issue. A second piece related to, more directly to the tax credit, is whether it affects take-up rates. And so it's possible, and I spent some time trying to find data on take-up rates are the percentage of people buying the insurance. And I believe there are some states that have a state-level incentive and some that don't. So a starting point for examining or making an estimate of the impact of the credit would be to compare take-up rates across states, and where you have kind of a natural experiment, states with the incentive and states without the incentive.
Are you able to find us that information?
I have looked so far, and I haven't been able to find that yet, but I will continue. And then presumably anybody listening to this who's a proponent or opponent, I guess, might be able to come forward with
insurance,
some information.
Insurance companies might have that information.
You might have that information.
Did you have a question down here?
Chair Kenny-Geyer, would the intent of the take-up rate, if you were able to get the take-up rate, then compare that to actually utilization of the tax claimants?
That would be a kind of a second step of the analysis. The first step might be, this is all kind of theoretical, kind of a research or analytical approach, kind of the process of the analytics to go through this would be make an estimate of whether or not an incentive has an impact on take-up rates. And if that result tends to be no effect, then that kind of ends the analysis, and there's an argument against having such an incentive. But if the result of that does indicate that there is a correlation between state-level incentives and take-up rates, then the question the questions continue. You know, what about the level of the incentive? Is a deduction just as valuable as a tax credit? Or do they need to be corresponding amounts? And then if those do have an effect on the take-up rates, then you get to the question of, okay, you have higher take-up rates. We have, just to run with that thought process, a $500 tax credit increases take-up rates by 5%. So now we have 5% more people buying this insurance. What does that mean for Medicare, Medicaid? And there's a timing piece. I mean, it's a long-term care insurance. So there's a significant timing piece to that analysis. And what does that do for the cost of those systems, moving them from the public sector to the private insurance sector? So there's a potentially long list of questions and a great deal of research that can be done. And I believe some of it is moving toward answering those questions. I'm just not able, I don't have a full bibliography, and I haven't been able to do an exhaustive research on that
well, body. It seems to me like if you were able to get that information, it would be interesting to see states that had this program but with a cost of living index added onto it, because if you don't have that, it's kind of self-defeating. I mean, it seems like it kind of phases itself out. But if you have that, you know, unfortunately we haven't had that, so you don't have that comparison. But some other states must have thought it through a little bit better in the 80s and put a COLA on it so that the incentive actually grew with the actual cost of it. Because now it seems like it'd be pretty hard to reap any benefit out of the size of the program.
Well, that's one of the aspects of that research would be, I kind of lumped all the states into either an incentive or not an incentive, but then you have different aspects of those incentives. Deductions, credits, inflation adjustment factors, and so forth. So there's potentially a lot of work that can be done and a lot of parameters to control for. And that can be difficult to control for those parameters, but I think some research has been out there, and I'll continue to see what I can find.
Representative Parrish?
So, I have a district where people probably take that credit. So a couple questions. One is, do you track at all sort of taxpayers, tax filers who take the credit and then at some point also start using the credit? Are they still staying here in Oregon, or are they taking this credit to like Florida or Arizona or somewhere else? I mean, they're taking their insurance and, you know, setting up shop in another state. I'd be curious to see sort of what the flight pattern is of people who are using that. You probably don't have an answer for that right now, but that's certainly a request. And then, you know, sort of the other thing that I'm curious about, and you might not have an answer for, is sort of the relation of people who've maybe taken credits like this, or if there's any data out there, taken the credits sort of self, were self-sufficient in that retirement type of, I mean, because I have facilities like Mary's Woods, which came up as part of the provider tax or, you know, for long-term care conversation, and I voted no because all of those folks are paying their full freight and not relying on, you know, the government to care for them. So I'm interested in seeing folks who have that, if we have the data, if they've used credits, if they go into and are sort of self-sustaining, you know, do they actually sort of slide back and then need government aid later on? Or does is this truly a mechanism that keeps them in a self-sufficiency stage through sort of their end of life? And you might not have those answers right off the top or even know if that data is out there, but I would be interested if it exists to bring that into this conversation.
I do take notes in these hearings to get at some of those questions, and you're correct. I don't have the answers.
You do a very good job.
off the top of my head, and I'll see what research. With something like this, I'm not even sure how recently long-term care insurance has been a high-profile issue, if you will. And so if people haven't been purchasing the credit for very long, we may not be very far into that other end of the users of this kind of insurance, but I'll see what I can find.
What follow up? If there's any data, even in the, not necessarily against the notion of us giving folks a credit to buy it, but long-term care insurance has been around for a while, so I don't know if there's any just sort of other data out there that talks about right. people using it who stay in sort of a self-sufficiency mode. You know, are they staying there longer? Which, if you can sort of maintain, obviously, through your retirement and until you are, you know, no longer with us, and not tap government dollars, you know, is it worth it for us to continue or extend or, you know, make it somehow more affordable for people on lower income levels to make those same buying choices? So.
Yep. Thank you, Chair. Kenny Geyer. Do you know, I'm trying to run the numbers on this, but what the total amount that this actually, this credit accounts for? Because I didn't see a slide on that. If you figure somewhere, based on your chart, somewhere around 32,000 people claiming it, if all of them took the maximum credit, then that's $16 million. And so I'm curious what it actually comes out to.
It, Rep. Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair, sorry, it's about $10 million a year.
Okay.
That's the cost of it.
And we don't know if it has actually accomplished its purpose.
Correct.
Okay.
And there's kind of a dual nature to the purpose. This would be one where I believe it was established in tax year 2000, and it was only for people who purchased long-term care insurance after 2000. And that was an issue back then because you had people who had purchased long-term care insurance before that date who were not eligible for the credit.
But do you know if there was a big bump up in purchasing of?
I haven't been able to find kind of third-party data. The only information I've been able to find are people using the credit. So from that perspective, the world kind of starts in 2000.
Right.
I haven't been able. I have to think that it's there somewhere. I just haven't been able to find it yet.
Well, and clearly all those people were new, but whether they were going to buy it anyway or whether it disincentivized them, how do you know?
And that's another layer to the question.
Yeah.
Maybe they were going to buy it anyway. But if I can get historical data and if we can, that would be an indication that if so much of the percentage of the population was purchasing it up to 1999,
right.
and that there was a bump,
right.
that suggests, it's not conclusive, but it is suggestive.
Right. Okay, Lewis.
Yeah, I find it's interesting. I mean, long-term care usually isn't that long. I mean, people are in, if they go into long-term care, that you know, they're either chronically ill and they don't last that long anyway. And it's like, so I guess that's another variable to look at. It's just people are getting insurance for long-term care, but to what extent do they actually end up using it? I don't know.
All right.
Do we include in the long-term care, I mean, now I'm sort of curious, Representative Gallegos' question brought up, you know, is it somebody who is in a medically need care situation or folks who sort of do the quasi, like, I'm giving up my home and I want to go be somewhere where there's sort of somebody caring for me and bringing me breakfast, but I can still get on the bus and go to bingo. Like, so I'm curious, I mean, do we define that there is a medical component that has to be happening in long-term care, or is it the notion that you're going into a state-licensed facility? And that's a different equation. I mean, our mayor in West Lynn just stepped down as mayor and said, hey, I'm going to sell my house and move into one of these facilities, and I don't expect him to keel over in the next, you know, short window of time.
I'd have to do more research on the users, because if I'm following your question, it's more characteristics of the users of long-term care insurance and when can they tap into it. Mm-hmm. I would think it would be more of a need-based, but I need to look into that a little bit more.
So are you going to be able to tell us on each of these tax credits how many how much of an overlap with the child and dependent care tax credit there is?
Yes.
That's, to me, the biggest umbrella. And these other ones all hit kind of pieces of it, and I'd love to know what the overlap is.
Madam Chair, yes, we can do that. I'm doing that from a tax year 2012 perspective.
Right.
And to some extent, there is, for all of the four disability tax credits, there was some degree of overlap for those. Very, very few claimed all of them, because then you're talking about disabled taxpayer with disabled children, that kind of thing. But the loss of limbs, for example, almost everybody who claimed that also claimed the severe disability. Mm-hmm. And then we can look at overlap with the child care credits. And I'm in the process of getting you that Venn diagram, that overlap of taxpayers for there. And that can apply to these tax credits as well.
Because, mm-hmm. I think the way I keep looking at this is if what we're trying to do is make life a little easier, have less of a financial burden for low-income people that are facing child care costs, or if their kids are not in child care, they're an income loss because they're home with young children, or people with taking care of people with disabilities, or people with disabilities themselves, elderly, or people taking care of elderly. We're trying to lessen the financial burden on them. And so if we can beef up the child and dependent care, perhaps make it refundable so that we shift it down to the low income, the people who have not been able to take advantage of that, and see, you know, how many people is that serving that all these little tax credits are claiming right now. But we don't want to, you know, if there's genuine populations that need it and can't fall under that, then we don't want to necessarily leave people out. We certainly don't want to inadvertently leave people out, but we've been covering.
Yeah, I think going through that process will, the hope is that it'll lead to the policy changes that you could make.
Right.
So that even if you want to go one direction and if that leaves somebody out, you can modify that policy, or maybe there's a different credit
right.
to get those people.
Right.
Chair Kenninger, one caveat to wanting to move this to, you know, push it towards lower income. I would agree with that all, with the exception of long-term care. It occurs to me that the intent of this may have been focused at higher incomes so that those people that actually have the resources have an incentive to do that. So even though they have the resources, they don't tap in to Medicaid or Medicare resources when they get older. So maybe the focus of this originally in 2000 was actually for higher income people that could afford to buy it to get them to do so.
Right.
So later on we don't have that burden. Because I just don't see, if we force this down to 30,000 or below, I just don't see people having the expendable cash to even want to buy that. You know, there's no incentive there for them.
Yeah, not a lot of people are.
So I think this one's a little bit different than the rest of it.
That is different. And then I don't know, you know, maybe John can help us up here. I don't know to what extent, if people are at upper incomes, they can tap into long-term care on Medicaid. And how much are we saving ourselves, or they've already priced themselves out and they can't get that. Anyway, I don't know enough about that system.
A couple layers of that is you're talking about a state incentive and federal dollars for the Medicare programs. And some of this, and I can look into this, is kind of an overlay of the income as well as the age. Because these aren't necessarily young low-income people.
Right.
They tend to be people who are 50 or older, who are going to be, you know, speaking very broadly, kind of at the height of their peaking, the height of their earning years, speaking very broadly. And that's another piece I can look at to see if anything comes out about that, that analytical process, seeing what's the relationship between the age of the taxpayers claiming it and the income levels, because there can be a high correlation there. But in getting back into the policy intent, do you want to get younger people or lower income people to get into the credit?
Any other questions?
Madam Chair, yes. Just one thing that I wanted to get on the record. If you do leave this credit in the state that it's in now, we wanted to point out that there's a, in conjunction with the itemized deductions and the new special organ medical subtraction, there's some overlap there that we wanted to make sure that it's pretty technical, but I wanted to make sure it was on the record so that we could talk about that and make sure you understood what the credit is currently doing.
For which credit are you talking about?
The long-term care insurance credit. There's some overlap that premiums are deductible on your Schedule A, and so there's a little bit of a double benefit there for some people, and I wanted to just make sure you're aware of that and that we that you knew that was the current interpretation of the law as it's written now, if you decide to leave it as it is.
So can you explain what that is, how that double credit happens?
There, part of the grand bargain on the Schedule A, taxpayers are allowed to deduct medical expenses above 10% of their income, of 10% of their AGI. Prior to the grand bargain, at the state level, there was termed an elderly medical deduction, so that taxpayers who are over age 62 could deduct the medical expenses up to 7.5% of their AGI, so that elderly taxpayers age 62 and over, could deduct all of their medical expenses on the Oregon return. Between part of it would show up on the federal form and part of it on the Oregon form.
And their spouses, whether they were 62 or not.
Yes, and yes, that's the policy. Mm-hmm. Part of the grand bargain converted that deduction. Mm-hmm. It was an itemized deduction, so to claim it on the Oregon return, they had to itemize their deductions. Part of the grand bargain converted that to a subtraction, which is a deduction, but everybody can claim it. Doesn't matter. You don't have to itemize your deductions. You get to claim that deduction. And it also put caps on it. It phased that subtraction out by income. So it was at most $1,800 and then $1,400 and then $1,000 and then zero as income increased.
And it phased it out at $100,000, is that right?
For single filers.
For single filers, right. And then double that for joint filers.
And so what's the problem with this?
What this is there's normally what you see in tax law is you see when there's a deduction, an expense is able to be deducted somewhere, mm-hmm. and then you give a credit for it also, then you can't also use those same expenses. So they add back the value of the deduction in order to claim the credit. So this doesn't have that particular provision. It's pretty technical, and they get a double benefit for the same expenses. Basically, they get the deduction and they get the credit. So that's current policy in here, and I just wanted to make sure that you were aware of it. And if you continue with this particular credit, that's out there.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. So you're saying that the premiums themselves can be listed as part of the medical deduction.
Correct.
And then, so they've already listed them as part of the medical deduction, gotten credit for that, and then the double dip is to mm-hmm. later list them as this and take this credit.
Madam Chair, Representative Stark, that is correct.
Okay.
Representative Pearson.
So we changed the senior medical tax deduction, mm-hmm. so some people aren't able to sort of double dip, but they could still take this credit, because not everybody is going to be in that double dip category.
If they're over 100,000, then this is the only one they can claim.
Mm-hmm.
Correct. And Madam Chair and Representative Parrish, there's a calculation that you have to go through to figure out if the expenses are the same, and because there's some limitations. It's pretty complex, but I just wanted you to be aware some taxpayers are able to, as Representative Stark say, double dip on this particular credit. And it's been that way since its inception. It's just become more noticeable because of the new subtraction.
Are you able to also break down the 100,000 more, like beyond, you know, how many are 500,000? I'd be curious.
Yes.
That's a pretty big bar, so I'd be curious to see how that breaks out.
Yes, I can. We can break that out in more detail. One of the challenges or with the presenting a lot of the different tax credits at the same time is just trying to maintain the kind of a scale. Otherwise, things, they can look deceptive if the scale changes from chart to chart.
Right.
But yeah, we can, I can get you more detail there.
Okay. Any other questions? Well, maybe this is good to chew on over the weekend. Not the last of the tax credits. We're going to be having a public hearing on this, I think, on March 6th, right? The
March
disability,
6th,
right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So for anyone that you know who's interested, to have them tune in if they want to hear some of the background on it and go to OLIS. And any other questions? I'm sure everyone wants to get out early on a Friday. So I'm going to close the informational meeting. And just an announcement, our next meeting we will hear House Bill 2564 on inclusionary zoning. House Bill 2015 on ERDC has been removed from the agenda for Monday, so please stay tuned to future agendas for a work session on this bill. And we adjourn. Have a good weekend. And we adjourn. Have a good weekend.